If anything positive could be said for the dry, hot weather, it was that it made her hair look much better. Usually she struggled with spontaneous curls, knots, strained-looking clumps, and an overall fuzziness. But here, her hair was as straight and smooth as a shampoo commercial model's. She smiled at the reflection. Not bad at all. After grabbing her purse and keys, she left the room and walked over to Tatum's door. She knocked on it. Her stomach rumbled. She knocked again. He opened the door looking tired and cranky. He wore a blue t-shirt and a pair of shorts. His eyes widened as he took in Zoe's appearance and attire. But then his jaw clenched, and he frowned. Hey. Zoe tried for a natural tone.
I was just about to call you, Tatum said.
You were? She asked, feeling encouraged.
I found one open murder case from 8 months ago that could be relevant to our investigation. The body of a 22-year-old prostitute named Laverne Whitfield was found buried a few miles north of San Angelo. Her arms were tied with an electrical cord, and she'd been stabbed several times.
How did they find the body?
Wild animals dug it up.
Any suspects?
One. A guy who used to be her pimp, named Alphonse something.
Tatum frowned.
I'll send you the case file. You can check out the exact details. It looked like a solid case, but when it got to court, the defense managed to point at some issues in the investigations. They'd missed a crucial witness, the time of death turned out to be wrong, and the main suspect wasn't Mirandized properly. A lot of the evidence was deemed inadmissible. The suspect walked.
And you think it's relevant? Zoe asked. Tatum shrugged.
She'd been buried. But it was obviously done to hide the body, which isn't the case with the current killer. The stabbing doesn't match the current MO either.
And she was found by wild animals, which means she wasn't buried deep.
Right. I don't think it's the same guy, but I wouldn't rule it out either.
Zoe nodded, agreeing with his assessment. I wanted to talk to you about something else. Regarding last night? Tatum's face remained impassive. I'm really sorry you feel like what I said was hurtful. I was trying to help, but I can see how you would see what I said as criticism. I can sometimes be a bit too blunt. She expected his face to soften a bit, but it remained tense, full of hard edges and angry angles. That thing in L.A. was years ago, and it's totally legitimate to want to avoid talking about it. I promise not to mention it again until you're ready. It almost seemed as if his jaw clenched tighter. Had he missed the initial part where she'd apologized? So, anyway, I'm sorry. I was about to go get something to eat. Do you want to join me? My treat.
You're sorry I feel that way, he said dryly.
Oh, he got that part after all. Yes.
You now realize you may have been too blunt.
This whole apologizing thing was not going as planned, and Zoe began to feel short-tempered. I really am sorry. Third time she said it. So, do you want to join me? I think there's a place.
I'm not hungry. Good night.
The door slammed. She stared at the closed door in disbelief, then just barely containing the urge to kick the door, she turned around and stormed off to get some dinner on her own. Chapter 27 Harry sat in the motel's lounge, just about to give up on his stakeout, when he noticed Zoe outside, walking briskly toward the street. For a moment, he almost didn't recognize her, the t-shirt and the jeans so different from the pantsuits he saw her wear in Chicago. But then she turned her head, and there was no mistaking that face. He lunged from the couch and dashed outside.
Dr. Bentley!
She paused and turned around, looking at him distractedly.
So nice to meet you here.
Harry mixed innocence and surprise in his tone, walking casually toward her. Her gaze focused and he halted in his place, a bit unsettled. As a child, he would often worry that some people could read his thoughts, know about all the dark corners of his soul. Zoe's eyes almost made him feel like that all over again.
You, she hissed. What are you doing here?
Oh, just... traveling for work, he said. I'm staying in this motel. What about you?
She blinked, and dismay showed on her face as she realized they were staying in the same place. Now that the initial shock of facing her intense glare had abated, he found something unquestionably alluring about her. Her delicate neck and her rich dark hair gave her an almost snow-white quality. But that delicacy was shattered by her strange eyes and crooked nose, morphing her from cute to mesmerizing. He made a mental note to mention that in his interview. He thought of other possible adjectives: captivating, gripping, spellbinding. No, spellbinding sounds ridiculous. "I'm here on," she hesitated. Finally, she blurted.
"Personal business."
"Personal business in San Angelo, huh? An agent, Tatum Gray, is also on personal business, I assume."
She glared at him for a long second. "I have nothing to say to you." She turned away and began marching. Harry hurried after her.
"No problem,"
he breathed hard. Damn, the woman could move fast.
"Maybe just comment on the article I have for tomorrow's paper. I'm considering the headline, 'Serial Killer Expert Consulting Local Police in San Angelo in Wake of Young Woman's Suspicious Death.'"
He wheezed as his heart and lungs screamed at the sudden unexpected effort. He hadn't moved so fast in years.
"I'll start by building the atmosphere."
He raised his voice to overcome the traffic noise. She got farther away, and he hastened his steps, gulping air between words.
"Dr. Bentley, famous for catching Chicago's strangling undertaker and the infamous Jovan Stokes, recently flew to San Angelo with her partner, Special Agent Tatum Gray. Though there was no comment regarding their presence, it is possible that it has something to do with the death of 19-year-old Nicole Medina."
Zoe slowed her steps and then stopped. Breathing hard, Harry stopped as well. He felt like he was going to have a heart attack.
"Who was found dead outside the city?"
Damn those cigarettes. They'd be the end of him.
"After being reported missing. Stop."
She whirled around and strode toward him, looking like she might strangle him. "You can't print any of that. That's just provocation and misinformation."
"Misinformation?"
He looked at her, hurt.
"Aren't you in San Angelo with Agent Tatum Gray? Wasn't Nicole Medina found dead? They said she was found dead in today's news." "Oh, I get it. You don't like the title, Serial Killer Expert. Fair enough. How about Renowned Profiler?"
"Mr. Barry, if you publish your article, the consequences might be..." "You can't..."
She waved her hands helplessly, her gestures frantic and vague.
"Use your words, Dr. Bentley. I don't understand sign language."
His heart rate was slowing down, but he was drenched in sweat. Maybe he should quit smoking.
"What consequences?"
"Please wait one more day before publishing anything."
She was not good at beseeching. Her tone made it sound more like an imperious order.
"So that all the local papers get the story before me?" "I don't think so, doctor. Do you have a quote for me or not?"
She stared at him. He met her gaze calmly, but it was like having a staring contest with Medusa. He ended up glancing away first.
"There's a story for you here," she finally said. "But if you go public now, with my name and a list of all my so-called accomplishments, I swear you'll never hear anything from me."
He shrugged.
"Doesn't seem like I'm hearing anything from you either way."
"I'll give you the whole story before anyone else, I promise."
"What if the rest of the press gets hold of it first?"
"You don't want to write about a dead girl in San Angelo. Your readers in Chicago couldn't care less about her. You want my angle on it."
"You can read me like an open book."
He grinned at her. "Wait with the article. I'll call you in a day or two." He nodded.
"I'll wait for your call. Just don't take too long."
She let out a long breath. "Good night."
"Did you eat dinner? We could grab something together."
"I'd rather dine with a rattlesnake, Harry Barry."
He watched her walking away, a bemused smile on his face. Then he rummaged in his pocket and took out a crumpled box of cigarettes. He tapped one out, put it between his lips, and lit it. He inhaled the smoke, shutting his eyes with joy. The hell with giving up smoking. He knew nothing better than the first cigarette after you snagged a good story. Chapter 28. The girl's screams were background music as he browsed the local news websites. She was pleading for someone, anyone, to get her out. He listened to her for a few seconds, comparing this girl to Nicole Medina.
He wasn't certain which one of them he found more engaging. Shaking his head, he sifted through the websites again. He'd been hoping that by now someone would make the connection, realize the girl who had died was the same one from the video he'd posted online. But all the articles just mentioned the bare facts. The dead victim's name and age, a selfie in a club the victim had posted 2 weeks ago on her Instagram account, the police statement that they were investigating it. No mention of a serial killer. No mention of the online video. No mention of Schrodinger. Article after article of bland, dry tidbits of information. He smacked the table in a sudden bout of rage. How could they be so blind? He'd left them a blazing trail. Did he need to force-feed them every tiny detail? He clicked the Contact Us link on the San Angelo Live website. Typing furiously, he pointed out the connection between the death of the victim and the video. He copied the URL. He pointed out the name of the video and stated there would be more. The police were helpless against him, and so were the FBI. There would be more victims, and no one was safe. They were all on his radar. There would be more. Dozens. The cursor hovered above the send button, and he paused. He read the entire thing again. He literally had to scroll to do it. It was so damn long. Almost half the words were in all caps. He sounded deranged. He spotted no less than 13 spelling mistakes. The number of exclamation marks was staggering. At one point, he'd written dozens with 6 exclamations. 6 exclamation marks. Capital letters, like some frothing madman. This was not the impression he wanted people to get, no matter how angry he was. He got up from his car and paced the basement, taking deep breaths. The space was a lot more cramped than it used to be. Boxes were stacked to the ceiling on the far side, their sizes uniform, each with a single hole drilled in it. Each box was intended for one subject, one experiment. Just looking at them calmed him down, made him smile. Next to them stood bins full of soil. He had enough for 5 experiments, matching the different locations' soil. This was who he was, someone who prepared, who tied every loose thread, who left nothing to chance. He'd stick to the original plan. So what if the press was a bit slow? Soon everyone would know about him, and everyone would be wondering who was next. Because this girl wouldn't only make him visible. It would also clarify he wasn't about to stop with 1 or 2. Her screams echoed in the basement again. She was screaming for her mother. And that gave him an idea. He should have thought about it long before. These days, no one cared about what was happening right now. All they talked about was what was about to come. There was always endless chatter about the trailers of future movies, the teasers, the hints and winks by the cast and the film crew. And after the movie screened, did anyone talk about them at all? Besides agreeing that they were kind of meh? Teasers and trailers, creating a buzz. The buzz was more important than the actual product. That would put him in the center of the public eye. Who would have guessed that what a serial killer would need these days was a good marketing department? He grinned as he left the basement. The idea was taking shape in his mind. Chapter 29. Zoe sat by the bar, her fists clenched on her lap. She couldn't figure out how the evening had managed to go so badly. First, Tatum's obnoxious behavior. Then that shameless reporter from Chicago somehow finding her here, twisting her arm for a lousy interview. Ugh, how had he even found her? He'd flown to San Angelo, and that meant he had a reliable source. Someone in BAU. She'd have to talk to Mancuso later, tell her someone was leaking info to the press. Here you go, miss. The bartender set 3 plates in front of Zoe. The first had a large, thick steak, fried on a pan, looking promisingly juicy. A small piece of broccoli sitting next to it almost as an afterthought. The other dishes were the side dishes. A salad, the vegetables crisp and fresh in an assortment of green and red, and a baked potato with a mound of sour cream and slices of green onion on top. At least one thing didn't disappoint tonight. If this food was half as good as it seemed, this would be a very satisfying meal. She sliced a piece of the steak. The inside was as pink as she'd hoped it would be. She put it in her mouth, shutting her eyes. Maybe life was worth living after all. She chewed carefully, enjoying the juicy, tender meat, and then forked a piece of the potato, making sure that it came with some sour cream and a green onion slice. She ate the entire bite. A slight miscalculation there. The potato burned her tongue, but it tasted perfect. Everything okay? The bartender asked politely, as she put a glass of water by the plates, its surface foggy with condensation.
Yes, it's great,
Zoe said, breathing through her nose. The bartender gave her an amused smile and walked away. Zoe took another bite from the steak. The night's events morphed in her mind. Harry Berry was possibly shameless, but he was also driven. She could appreciate someone who was dedicated to his job. And Tatum. Well, Tatum was still obnoxious, but she knew his heart was in the right place. She was sorry he hadn't joined her. Food this good could work well with some company. A sudden stab of guilt and fear shot through her as she realized that she'd been so busy working the case that she'd forgotten to check up on Andrea since that morning. Almost a full day. She took out her phone. You okay? She tapped. The answer came after a few seconds. Yes, stop bugging me, I'm eating dinner. She sighed in relief and photographed the dish, sending it to Andrea with the caption, Me too. After a moment, her sister sent her back a text. You think you are having a good dinner? Check out what you're missing. And an image of sad-looking ramen noodles. Zoe snorted and sent back the laughing emoji with the tears. Sometimes it was just tearful laughing emoji time. After half the steak was gone, the bartender put a bottle of wine and a glass on the bar. Courtesy of the dude over there, she told Zoe, nodding to the edge of the bar. She placed a glass of wine in front of Zoe. Zoe said, I don't. It's really good wine, the bartender raised her eyebrow. It had been a while since someone had tried to pick her up in a bar, and she had to smile. Okay, thanks. She sniffed the wine, then tasted it. It really wasn't bad. She glanced at the man who'd sent her the glass. He had curly hair and a thick brown beard. He wore a checkered blue shirt that would have looked bad on most men, but not on him. He had a whole woodcutter vibe going for him. A small tattoo marked his neck. It seemed like initials, but Zoe couldn't make them out from this distance. He raised a glass of beer as a toast. She raised her own glass. He seemed to decide that was an invitation, and she wasn't sure it wasn't. He stood up, easily towering above most of the bar patrons, and ambled over, sitting down on the empty stool next to her.
I like to see a girl who can enjoy her dinner, he smiled.
Not really a girl. I'm 33. She put down the glass. Thanks for the wine.
I'm Joseph.
Zoe offered her hand. Zoe. For a moment, when he took her hand, she tensed, thinking he might kiss it, but he just shook it firmly.
You aren't from around here, he said. Are you from Boston?
She blinked in surprise. Is my accent that obvious? He laughed.
I lived in Boston for a few years, so my ears are well-tuned. It isn't very obvious, but it's there, being 33 and all.
His voice adopted a preposterous Bostonian accent, his smile mischievous. Zoe returned a smile. Well, I don't live there anymore either. She suddenly felt a strange jolt of homesickness. She took another sip from the wine.
So what are you doing in San Angelo? Did you move here?
No, I'm here for work.
What kind of work?
Now there was a question. The words forensic psychologist had a certain curse to them. They made people either uncomfortable or intensely curious, sometimes both. So naming her profession would either kill the conversation or shift it to revolve around homicide and rape. She took a bite from her steak, thinking about it. Both possibilities didn't sound too good. She was content to enjoy her nice dinner and the so far pleasant company, and she didn't want serial killers intruding on it. I'm a consultant.
A consultant on what?
He took a long gulp from his beer. Oh, human behavior mostly, she shrugged. I just flew here yesterday. I'll be here for a few more days. What about you?
I live here.
He smiled.
Born and raised in sand and jello.
It took her a minute to understand that it was a silly pun on the city name. She smiled back and ate a bite of potato with cream.
I'm an electrician and an air conditioning technician. It's a popular occupation.
He leaned closer.
I don't know if you realize it, but the weather can occasionally get a bit warm around here.
She burst out laughing and then began coughing uncontrollably. The potato inhaled into her trachea. Joseph gaped at her in alarm and then quickly handed her the water glass. She took it from him, still coughing, her eyes watering, and drank a bit, finally getting her breathing in order. Smooth, Zoe, very smooth.
Are you all right?
Yeah. She wheezed and drank half her glass. You just caught me off guard.
Sorry, I'll try to be more serious when you're eating.
So what were you doing in Boston if air conditioning technicians are so much in demand here?
Followed a girl there. What else? Tried to start a business for lighting fixtures when I was there. It actually looked like it was booming for a couple of years. And then it wasn't.
He picked up a beer coaster and began peeling it, scattering shreds of paper on the bar.
Broke up with the girl, so I came back home. And looking back, I don't know why I ever left.
Zoe sawed a piece of steak and chewed. She was over being hungry and ate mainly for the joy of it. She pointed at the initials tattooed on his neck. Who's H.R.? He touched the spot of the tattoo.
Henrietta Ross. That was the girl from Boston. Kinda stupid, huh? You do the dumbest things when you're in love. Now I'm stuck with her name and everyone asks me who that is.
He frowned at the beer coaster he peeled. Zoe had the feeling that if Andrea had been there, she would have managed to say something funny and turn the conversation around. She tried to think of something. She considered, you could tell them it stands for human resources, but was pretty sure it was as lame a joke as could be. She could start with, hey, at least her initials weren't. But she couldn't think of a punchline. She'd figure out something funny to say eventually. 3 days from now, when she'd be trying to sleep. I don't think it's stupid, she ended up saying, feeling lame. I think you loved someone and made a nice gesture. He blinked.
Thanks, Zoe. That's a sweet thing to say.
Maybe humor was overrated after all. Silence settled between them. It wasn't the comfortable silence of people who knew each other well. It was that tense silence, electric and sharp, almost tangible. As if there were an imaginary conversation ball they tossed to each other, and one of them had just fumbled, letting the ball drop. He cleared his throat.
So, who are the most important people in your life?
It was a jarring question, unrelated to their conversation earlier. But Zoe could see it for what it was, the means to resuscitate the conversation, get it back on track. She was fine with that. I have a sister. She lives with me.
Really? Isn't that difficult, living with your sister?
Maybe for her, she said lightly. I love having her around.
What about your parents?
My dad died a few years ago, and my mother can be a bit difficult. Her mother, always a controlling, passive-aggressive woman, had become almost impossible to bear in the last few years. What about you?
I don't have any siblings, and my dad left Texas a few years ago. So it's only me and my mom, but we're very close.
I bet she was happy when you came back.
She was thrilled, he said. Never wanted me to leave in the first place.
They talked a bit about Boston, then the conversation veered left and right, with Joseph steering it and Zoe content to take the passenger seat. He told her about his hobby of restoring old furniture for a bit, and Zoe did her best to act sufficiently impressed when he described the restoration of an ancient dresser. Her own experience of furniture building, constructing 3 chairs bought from IKEA, was not included in the conversation. Then they compared some favorite movies. Joseph asked for a wine glass for himself. After a while, Zoe found that she was lowering her guard with him, words flowing more easily. When had she last just sat down with someone, talking with him about inconsequential matters, enjoying the company? Long after the bartender took away her mostly empty plates and the wine's last drops had been sipped, Joseph asked,
"What are your plans for the rest of the evening?"
Zoe tensed. It was nearly midnight, While she enjoyed Joseph's company, she didn't want the evening to continue. She still didn't know enough about him, except for the fact that he was very large and pretty charming. Then again, she knew of other charming men. Ted Bundy, Charles Manson, Richard Ramirez, Rod Glover. The list went on and on. For someone who dealt with psychopaths all day, charm became nothing more than dangerous camouflage. "I think I need to sleep," she said. "I have an important day tomorrow."
"A day of consulting, huh?"
"That's right." She tried to smile, but wasn't sure it came out right.
"Can you drive?"
He glanced at her wine glass. He didn't need to know that she had a room nearby. "I'll get a taxi." He fished a business card out of his wallet.
"If you feel like having another nice dinner tomorrow, give me a call."
She thanked him. He gave her another final smile that seemed to be a bit confused and left. "Can I get the bill?" she asked. "He already paid for everything earlier, when you were in the bathroom," the bartender said. "A real gentleman." "Yeah," Zoe echoed. "A real gentleman." Chapter 30. San Angelo, Texas. Thursday, September 8th, 2016. Delia was folding the clean laundry, matching socks, when the home phone rang. All of Frank's socks were either gray or black, which meant she had to compare their length and fabric to make an actual pair. Sometimes she wouldn't bother, making pairs of short socks with long socks, woolly socks with paper-thin socks. That usually resulted in a litany of complaints, so right now she tried to do it right. For the life of her, she couldn't find the pair of the socks she held. The phone's ring made her jump, her head turning left and right like a hunted animal. It wasn't only that she'd been deep in thought. It was that this phone almost never rang. Both she and Frank used their mobile phones, and everyone knew that that was the way to reach them. In fact, the main reason they hadn't disconnected the phone line long ago was that Frank's mother, Gerda, would always call that number. Gerda had been an old woman, her memory dissipating, and Frank despaired of trying to make her call him by his new number. The president had a red phone to talk to Russia, and the Howe family had a beige phone to talk to Gerda. Except, Gerda had been dead for over 7 months. Delia nestled her aching hand, her mind fuzzy with physical pain. It was a wrong number or a survey or a salesman, with a deal she couldn't refuse. Regardless, it was an annoyance. She decided to ignore it, waited for the ringing to end. It didn't. It kept ringing and ringing maddeningly loudly. These old-fashioned phones had been designed to ring as loud as possible so you'd hear them no matter where you were in the house. Finally, impatient with the noise, Delia got up and picked up the phone. "Hello." Her tone was sharp, angry, meant to clarify that she was not someone who wanted her time wasted. Silence on the other end. And something soft. A hint of breath. No, not breathing. Sobbing. "Hello?" she asked, her voice softer, scared. And then, ever so faintly, "Maribel?" For a second, the person on the other line just kept sobbing. But then she called out, her voice broken and terrified.
"Mommy? Maribel, where are you? Are you all right? Hello?"
She waited for a second after each question, but Maribel only cried harder, apparently unable to answer.
"Maribel! Mommy! Where are you? I'll come and get you. Just tell me where you are." "Get me out of here,"
Maribel screamed.
"Please." "Out of where? Where are you?"
The line went dead. Delia stared at it in disbelief. And then, letting the phone drop, she rushed for her mobile phone, where she kept the phone number of Detective Lyons. Chapter 31. Tatum was a few minutes late to the morning meeting and got an admonishing stare from Jensen, which he ignored with practiced ease.
"Right," Jensen clapped his hands. "Where's Lyons? I want to start."
"She'll probably be here in a moment," Foster said.
"Well, we can't wait for her. Where are we with the case, Detective Foster?"
Foster flipped through his notebook.
"We talked to all the friends who were with Medina the night she disappeared. Between their testimonies and the red light camera footage, we feel safe saying she was dropped off in front of her house at 1:15. All the neighbors were sleeping. The mother woke up at 6:30, saw Nicole never got home, reported Nicole missing at 7:35 after calling everyone she could think of. We're talking to eyewitnesses at the party and some of Nicole's other friends, but so far nothing stands out.
Okay.
Jensen clapped his hands again.
So maybe.
Lyons has been going through the red light cam footage,
Foster continued.
Three vehicles followed the car Nicole was in. Two of them belonged to teenagers returning from the same party. The third was a truck driven by a 47-year-old man named Wyatt Tiller. We're looking into it, though I doubt he's our man.
Foster flipped a page in his notebook.
Some of Nicole Medina's friends had erected a small memorial shrine on her street. It looks harmless. There's nothing there that the press might have a field day with. Can you monitor visitors to the shrine?
Tatum asked.
The killer might visit it.
Foster considered it.
We can't have a man stationed there, but I see no problem with installing a small surveillance camera.
What about the crime scene? Zoe asked Foster. Did you scan it with UV light? Tatum was mildly irritated, realizing she'd followed up on something that he wasn't privy to.
The crime scene techs found no indication of any foreign fluids that show up under UV light.
Foster paused for a second, letting it sink in, then continued.
Regarding the box, we consulted with an expert carpenter, and he said that he estimates the box was made by a professional. If our killer isn't a carpenter, he must have ordered it from somewhere. We want to follow that trail, but we frankly need more manpower.
Well,
Jensen said. Tatum sighed. And here begins the manpower mating dance. They argued for a bit. Eventually, a compromise was reached. Tatum wasn't sure what the bottom line was, but both Foster and Jensen seemed disgruntled and unhappy. Then it was Agent Shelton's turn to speak, and he briskly outlined their efforts at tracking the killer via the online video he'd posted. It didn't sound promising. The hosting service had been paid for in Bitcoin. The domain was free and registered under a temporary email account.
The unsub used a second burner phone as a hotspot to post the video, and that phone was switched on and off at the site,
Shelton added, using the short term for unknown subject.
We're monitoring both phone numbers in case one of them is switched on again.
He glanced at his laptop, which was open in front of him.
Lab results indicate all DNA samples retrieved from the box belong to the victim.
Jensen turned wearily to Tatum.
What about you? Any progress with the killer's profile?
We're searching for similar crime patterns,
Tatum said.
So far, we found nothing. Dr. Bentley also pointed out we should probably look into Schrodinger and understand his theory. It might shed some light on the murderer.
That's a good idea.
Jensen beamed in a manner that made Tatum feel instantly suspicious.
Well, yeah. I'll look into that today.
I am friends with San Angelo's number one physics doctor at Angelo State University,
Jensen said.
We know each other from college. I can set up a meeting.
I have a bit to add, Zoe interrupted.
Oh,
Jensen turned to her.
What did you find, Agent, Dr. Bentley?
I composed a basic profile from what we know about the killer, she answered. Nothing definite, of course, but I think I managed to pinpoint a few likely characteristics. Jensen pursed his lips skeptically, but the two detectives focused on Zoe with interest. The killer is uncommonly careful, leaving no trace behind him, which leads me to believe he's at least 30, probably even a bit older. Younger killers are usually more impulsive in their actions. However, he's in good shape. Those bins on the video were heavy. That grave was hard to dig. He didn't seem in any discomfort during the video, despite the hard work. That makes me think he's no older than 45.
I have an uncle who runs marathons and he's 60,
Jensen said. Tatum cleared his throat.
That's why Dr. Bentley said these are likely characteristics. We're not telling you to ignore anyone who's 20. But we recommend that you prioritize your investigation according to our recommendations.
For a second, his eyes locked with Zoe's. She gave a short, curt nod. The unsub was careful to avoid showing his skin in the video, wearing long gloves, high boots, and a long-sleeve shirt. All this was probably done to avoid giving us any hint regarding his race. But the video was streamed live, and he must have assumed he might accidentally show a bit of skin during his hard work. This leads me to believe he wasn't too worried about it. Didn't think that it would narrow down the search by much. Since San Angelo's demographic is mostly white, I assume it means he's white. Foster scribbled in his notebook furiously. From the cleanliness of the crime scene and the quite elaborate murder, we can tell he has an obsessive personality, paying meticulous, often excessive attention to details. If he has a job, it would be one where speed is not very important, but thoroughness is. That would probably mean he's not in customer service jobs or menial jobs. He's highly intelligent and is prone to show it off. This is almost certainly due to an inherent low self-esteem, which makes me think he was either belittled by his parents or bullied as a child. He probably endured some sort of abuse as a child. The door opened and Lyons entered the room wearing a haunted expression. Without saying a word, she sat down at the end of the table. Zoe continued. He has a van, and it would be the most common van around these parts. She shrugged. I don't know about Kaz. Jensen blinked.
That's a very detailed agent, doctor.
She didn't seem to hear him or care for his feedback. He had a stressful event in his life a few months ago, which made him feel unappreciated and angry. It is likely job-related. Maybe he was fired, something made him feel undervalued, demoted. We call this trigger a stressor.
The stressor could also be a relationship ending, Tatum pointed out. It's not necessarily job-related.
That's true, Zoe admitted. But I feel like the video was a performance, compensating for what he felt. He posted it online for everyone to see. He wants affirmation from the public. The name he gave himself, Schrodinger. As well as presenting the video as an experiment, it feels like an attempt to appear skilled and clever. Someone who deserved the appreciation of his superiors and peers. Tatum wasn't sure he agreed with her assessment, but decided to leave it. Also, I think it's likely Nicole Medina wasn't his first victim. The crime scene doesn't match the impulsive act of someone who killed for the first time. It looks like it was coldly planned by someone who killed before. 6 weeks ago, a 22-year-old woman named Maribel Howe was reported missing. The case file is still open. Detective Lyons and I talked to the mother yesterday. And I think it's possible Maribel is another victim. Jensen glanced at Lyons.
Oh.
Lyons cleared her throat. I have news about that, she said, her voice haggard. I just talked to the mother. She told me she got a phone call from Maribel. I couldn't get the exact details from her, but she sounded hysterical. I asked dispatch to send a patrol unit there to talk to her, and I'll go there myself to take her statement.
Right,
Jensen clapped his hands.
Meanwhile, Bentley and Gray will join me to hear what my physicist friend thinks.
Tatum was suddenly sorry for suggesting they learn more about Schrodinger. For one, he wanted to know more about Maribel Howe. And being with Jensen felt like having an unpleasant rash. Chapter 32 Tatum frowned as he followed Jensen's car. It was a testament to how badly things were between Zoe and him that she'd said she'd ride with the lieutenant. Tatum was terrible at holding a grudge. He knew some people did it with ease, practically turning it into a hobby. His aunt could recall what her frenemy had told her in eighth grade as easily as if she was recalling an event from the night before. But Tatum had to make a constant effort to do it, and it exhausted him. Jensen parked the car in the university's parking lot, and Tatum found a parking spot not far off. He joined Zoe and Jensen, and they all walked to the physics department. On their way, Jensen checked his messages and let out a curse.
The press found out about Maribel Howe's phone call.
So fast? Zoe asked.
The girl's mother probably called them straight away.
She didn't strike me as the type, Zoe said. Jensen didn't seem to be listening.
Some of them are hinting at links between Howe and Medina. This is blowing up in our faces. I knew we should have given them more at the press conference.
His tone shifted, becoming accusatory. Zoe pursed her lips. Tatum didn't try to intervene. Arguing with the lieutenant was useless, he knew. The man was already trying to find someone to pin this on in case he was blamed. Dr. Cobb's office was on the third floor, and the door was open, but Jensen knocked on it anyway and said,
"Knock, knock,"
in a way that was perhaps meant to be endearing. Tatum glanced into the room. Dr. Cobb was far from what Tatum had expected a physicist to look like. Cobb was a thin, black-haired woman wearing a buttoned white shirt and a pair of jeans. Her glasses were neither thick nor round, but delicate and square. She had a bright red lipstick on, which instantly made Tatum think of one of his early crushes in high school. "Ah," she said, her voice cool.
"When you called, I thought I'd have some time to work before you showed up."
Her voice and demeanor hinted that Jensen might have exaggerated when he called her a friend.
"How are you, Helen?"
Jensen asked, beaming. He entered the room and seemed about to hug her. The doctor, clearly anticipating the move, stuck out her hand, and Jensen, after a moment of hesitation, shook it. Zoe and Tatum entered the room, and Tatum shut the door. He took one of the empty chairs in the room.
"Helen, these are Dr. Bentley and Agent Gray from the FBI,"
Jensen said, and then gestured at her, glancing at Tatum.
"And this is Dr. Helen Cobb."
Dr. Cobb nodded at them.
"Nice to meet you. I understand you need my help with a case?"
"There's a killer who seems drawn to Schrodinger," Tatum said. "We need a crash course about the cat experiment."
Cobb sighed.
"Well, it's more of a thought experiment. Schrodinger never actually tormented any cats, as far as I know. The experiment is aimed to demonstrate a problem in the two-state quantum system. In quantum physics, we say a quantum can be in two different separate states at once. We call that superposition."
Tatum could already feel his attention snagged by random thoughts. It was like being in school all over again, the drone of the teacher turning into a background noise as he fantasized about the girl who sat in front of him, about his afternoon plans, about frogs, about anything else, really. Schrodinger wanted to demonstrate that there is an inherent problem with superposition, Cobb continued. So he formed this thought experiment, who put a cat in a box. In that box, there is a flask of acid connected to a device that has a Geiger counter and radioactive matter. Enough radioactive matter that in 1 hour, there is a 50% chance one of the atoms decays. If it decays, the acid kills the cat. If it doesn't, the acid remains in the flask. With me so far? Tatum wasn't sure. He really tried, but he was momentarily distracted by Cobb's lips. How did her students ever manage to concentrate during class? He tried to pull his focus back together. A cat and some acid. Right. The matter in the device is in superposition. It decayed, but it also didn't decay. It's in two states at once. The cat was either exposed to the acid or he wasn't, which means he's both dead and alive at the same time. He's in superposition.
But he is either dead or alive. He can't be both.
Zoe sounded irritated. Tatum wondered why she found this so offensive. Perhaps she was averse to cruelty against imaginary cats.
Well, the thought experiment states he's in superposition, because he's in a closed, unobserved device that is in superposition. So the cat and the device are in the same state.
When you say unobserved, what does that mean?
Zoe asked.
Superposition can only exist if the matter isn't measured. Once it's measured, it can't be in several states at once.
What if we looked at the cat via a video?
Then it wouldn't be unobserved, so the cat wouldn't be in superposition.
What if we observed the cat through a video, but then the feed was terminated?
Tatum asked, suddenly tense.
And then the experiment carried on without anyone observing it.
Cobb hesitated.
After a while, the cat would be in superposition. He would be both alive and dead.
Was that why the killer had cut the feed? Leaving them in uncertainty? Was it part of the experiment? Tatum clenched his jaw. Would he do other experiments?
What if there was no acid in the box?
Zoe asked, rummaging in her handbag.
Then the cat would presumably stay alive.
Cobb scrunched her eyebrows.
But he could die from lack of air.
Zoe pulled out a copy of the case file and flipped through it, a pen in hand. She made a small notation on one of the pages.
Yeah, but that's not a consequence of a quantum device, so he wouldn't be in superposition. He would be either alive or dead, not both. But we don't know which. Doesn't it mean he's in superposition? No, Cobb shrugged. My husband is currently at home. He's either eating or showering or reading or whatever, and I have no idea which. That doesn't mean he's in superposition, because his state isn't connected to a particle. And obviously he isn't a particle. He's my husband. That's also part of the problem with the experiment. It has been proved a cat can't be in superposition. Why not? Because he's too big. Big things can't be in superposition. It doesn't matter if the cat explodes or not. It would never be in superposition because he's too big.
Explodes? Zoe asked.
You said he's killed by acid. Well, in Einstein's version, he'd explode. Einstein's experiment had a barrel of explosives. It really doesn't matter. The point is, it's something that kills the cat. Apparently, physicists like to theoretically abuse cats in any number of ways. Perhaps Marvin would find that notion appealing, considering his long feud with Freckle.
So humans can't be in superposition either, right?
He asked. Of course not. Humans are bigger than cats.
Dr. Cobb, Zoe said. Was the experiment ever performed?
God, I hope not. Cobb shuddered. What would be the point? The entire thing is intended to demonstrate a paradox. You don't actually need to trap a cat in a death machine to do it.
Unless the purpose of the experiment was different and wasn't about science at all. Chapter 33. Andrea missed Boston. That was the main thing she realized as she ran on the gym's treadmill. She missed jogging through Boston Common. Right now, the trees would be turning yellow, red, and pink, and running through that explosion of color would be... A loud grunt erupted behind her. Much better than this. The man had been grunting intermittently for the past half hour as he tackled the various weightlifting machines. Men weren't grunting around her when she jogged through Boston Common. When she'd moved to Dale City, she couldn't wait to get away from Boston. But it wasn't Boston she wanted to escape from. It was her soul-crushing job as an insurance claims agent. It was Derek and their shambles of a relationship. It was her mother, less than an hour drive away, constantly nagging her to get married, 10 times worse since Andrea's father had died. So when Zoe had told her she was leaving Boston, moving to Virginia, all Andrea could think of was that she wanted to leave as well. She had a romantic idea of the two Bentley sisters conquering Dale City together. Another grunt pierced the air. Andrea rolled her eyes and increased her jogging speed, regretting leaving her earphones at home. Reality had hit her fast. Zoe had a very busy job at Quantico. All of Andrea's work experience was at a job she'd sworn to never do again. So she'd ended up as a waitress in a mediocre restaurant. The dating scene in Dale City wasn't much to talk about either. It got to the point that one sad evening, she'd called Derek to ask how he was doing. Worst phone call ever. Derek wasn't broken-hearted, pining for her. No, Derek was just fine. In fact, he had a girlfriend. He'd lost weight. And now she didn't even have her job anymore. Her savings account was emptying at an alarming rate. Sure, Zoe would be happy to lend her some money. Hell, Zoe would be happy to just give her money. She'd actually offered to. But Andrea hadn't hit that rock bottom yet. Ugh! This time it was a woman grunting. What was with these people? A month before, when she'd found out about Rod Glover, she'd been horrified. She hadn't remembered what he looked like, and he'd seemed like a nice, somewhat quirky man when he'd approached her on the street, hugging her arm as he took the picture, thanking her politely later. Sure, she knew about that event when they were kids, the horrible night Rod Glover had tried to break into the room while they huddled inside. Zoe had talked about it more than once, but she had no recollection of it. Except, maybe a fragment. Her sitting on the bed, terrified of something outside, and Zoe hugging her, whispering, "Don't worry, Ray Ray, he can't hurt us." Now she knew. The man from the street had been the same monster who'd killed 3 girls in Maynard and at least 2 more in Chicago. He'd attacked her sister in Chicago as well, tried to rape and kill her. This was the man who'd told her, "Smile," before taking the picture.
Sometimes her upper arm where his fingers had touched her tingled, as if hundreds of tiny insects were crawling on it. She'd have to take a shower for the sensation to pass. They were synchronized now, sounding like a couple engaged in the world's most uncomfortable and unpleasant sex act. The girl on the treadmill next to Andrea stopped running and left, a disgusted look on her face. At first, Andrea hadn't been able to sleep. She'd have nightmares and would wake up, listening to the building's noises, every creak, every neighbor's footstep, every unfamiliar sound. They all became him, coming for her, to rape her and strangle her to death, like he had to those other girls. She'd found Zoe's notes about him, read some of them, seen pictures from crime scenes. These things were seared in her mind, impossible to scrub away. She'd been terrified. But no one had seen him since that day. Slowly, she'd become convinced he'd left. He'd wanted to freak her and Zoe out, and now he was far away. Agent Caldwell, Zoe's co-worker, had explained that Rod Glover was an opportunistic sexual predator. He struck when an opportunity presented itself. He didn't target specific women, and he didn't want to get caught. They had no reason to think he was still around. The fear had abated, though Zoe was still anxious, hovering over Andrea, suffocating her, to the point that Andrea had begun to resent her. And now she missed Boston desperately. She had nothing going for her here. Running on this treadmill was a perfect metaphor for her life in Dale City. Another grunt behind her, so ridiculously loud that Andrea shot a furious glance backward. A glimpse of something snagged her attention. She faced forward again, her mind sluggishly processing what she'd just seen. A man was staring at her from the corner of the gym, partially hidden by one of the machines. Middle-aged, lanky hair, a weird smile. She'd looked at the photo enough times to know who he was. Rod Glover. He was here right now, watching her. Her heart was racing, but she kept running, eyes locked forward. She was suddenly thankful for the grunting man and woman and the rest of the people around her. They all kept her safe. Tears of fear filled her eyes as all the images from the crime scene photos popped into her mind. The dead, naked women, their bodies discarded on the ground. He was here, the monster who'd done this, just behind her. Did he realize she'd seen him? Was he walking toward her right now? That sick smile on his face, hand wielding a knife? She couldn't look. Her feet kept moving, running. She was living through that common nightmare, trying to run away from a monster but staying in the same spot. Zoe had given her clear instructions for what she should do if she saw Glover. She should scream and run, fight if there was no other option. But if she screamed now, he'd just know she'd seen him. And then what? She tried to scream anyway, but her throat was clogged, empty of breath. She had to get away from him. Her hand reached forward, stopping the treadmill. The machine slowed down and she got off, walking away, doing her best to seem casual. She desperately tried to catch a glimpse of him from the corner of her eye. Was he following her? No way of knowing. She hurried to the locker room. Her phone was in the locker room. She could call the police or the FBI or Zoe. She glanced at a mirror on the wall. Didn't see him. She was trembling, lips quivering, trying to reassure herself by the people around her. Glover struck women who were on their own. He didn't want to get caught. She'd call the police, get cops to surround the place. They'd arrest him. She'd be okay. She dove into the locker room, going for the lockers, momentarily confused. Which locker was hers? Then she found it, grabbed the combination lock, wrestled with it, fingers shaking. The locker room was empty, she suddenly realized. She'd entered an empty room with only one door. She was essentially trapped. She nearly bolted out right there and then, leaving her bag and phone behind her. But suddenly, she wasn't sure he wasn't waiting for her outside the door. Wasn't it what he did? Hide, waiting for his victims to walk by? The lock clicked and she wrenched the door open. Fumbling in the bag, she found her phone and dialed 911. 911, what's your emergency?
Rod Glover, there's a serial killer. He's following me. I'm in the gym.
Ma'am, calm down. You're in the gym? Are there people around you?
Not right now.
Her voice was high-pitched, panicky.
I'm in the locker room. There's no one here. And there's a murderer. Who is stalking me?
Can you get to somewhere public, ma'am? She held the phone to her ear, unable to talk. The locker room door had a window of frosted glass, and a shadowy figure appeared in it, looming as it came closer. She quickly ran to the other end of the room, entering the farthest shower stall. Ma'am.
Please, send cops over,
she said in a low voice. Can you give me an address? She had no idea what the address was.
I'm at the gym, nearby Cheshire Station.
Okay, ma'am, I'm sending a patrol over. Can you try and get to somewhere public until they arrive? Was the shadow still by the door? She didn't even dare look.
I'm scared.
Her voice was hardly more than a whisper. I understand. The operator sounded calm, in control, like Zoe always was. God, Andrea wanted Zoe there right now. But if you're in the gym, where there are a lot of people, you're safe. Just go wait at the lobby for the police, okay? Keep me on the line and walk to the lobby.
Okay.
She crept toward the locker room door, her breath shallow, her heart feeling as if it were submerged in ice. She stepped softly on the wet floor, wiping the tears of fear from her eyes. Footsteps. Movement at the frosted window. Someone was approaching.
He's coming for me! Help! Help!
She screeched. The phone tumbled from her frozen fingers. Scream and run. If you can't run, fight, Zoe had said. Andrea screamed, stumbling back, yelling as hard as she could. She couldn't run, and she didn't think she could fight. Only screaming was left. She screamed again, trying to summon anyone who could get there in time to save her. A sweaty, fat woman stepped into the locker room, staring at Andrea in confusion and worry. Andrea fell to the floor, sobbing, the operator's voice calling her from the discarded phone on the floor. Chapter 34. Zoe sighed and leaned back in her chair, the late afternoon sun slanting through the meeting room window, blinding her. She moved around the table to a position where the sun wouldn't bother her or reflect on her laptop screen. The details about Maribel Howe's phone call to her mother were sparse and frustrating. There was a record of an incoming phone call to the Howe residence. That much was true. However, they had no way of knowing who it was. Delia Howe repeatedly claimed it was Maribel, but added the girl hadn't said much, and whoever it had been called her mommy, which, Delia admitted, Maribel hadn't done since she'd been a small child. It all felt like there was a chance it was a prank call. The phone she'd used was still on, but the accuracy of its exact position was poor. It was somewhere in South San Angelo, in an area that contained over 700 houses. Cops were doing a door-to-door search, but they couldn't get a search warrant for 700 homes, and a lot of homes were vacant, their owners at work. And while they were doing that, other aspects of the investigation stalled. Foster also told Zoe that the toxicology report had come back. The victim had traces of flunitrazepam in her system. Rohypnol. That clarified how the killer had been able to handle her and put her in a box without any struggle. She mulled over it, distractedly doodling on the page in front of her. She was about to call Delia Howe to get the facts straight when Tatum entered the room.
Hey, he said. I wanted to talk to you.
What is it? She asked. She surprised herself with the eagerness in her voice.
I had an idea about the case. I wanted to hear what you think.
Shoot.
You think this serial killer is obsessed with his own fame, right?
It's definitely part of his motivation.
Could be a mind game he's playing with the police?
Tatum asked.
A way of establishing his superiority?
Zoe considered this. Maybe he wants to prove his superiority publicly. If it was just about being superior to the police, he'd have sent the video just to them, which would have been much safer.
That fits the profile for the kind of killer who'd want to involve himself with the case, right?
Many serial killers gravitated to the police investigation, making themselves part of it. A lot of times, they were actually the ones who